Welcome to the Casey Kohar Show, a celebration of words. And I'm delighted to have back for the seventh time today James Lee Burke, and we'll be discussing The Glass Rainbow, recently published by Simon & Schuster. And first of all, Jim, thank you very much for taking the time for talking with us today for the seventh time.
Well, thanks a million. I've been on your show quite a few years now. It's an honor to be back again.
Yeah. And, Jim, The Glass Rainbow, I thoroughly enjoyed this novel. It was a bit different when I first started reading it. It took me a little bit of time to kind of figure out where you were going with it. Once I did, I just went willingly. And this is the 18th in the Robichaux series?
That's correct.
Yeah. And tell us a little bit about The Glass Rainbow. Dave Robichaux, he's back in New Iberia. It starts out kind of like there is a lot of a mystery to it about seven women have been raped and mutilated. And why don't you tell us just a little bit about where you were going with The Glass Rainbow when you started writing it?
Well, the story about the homicides, the unsolved homicides of the women, is based on real material. Those homicides have occurred in Jefferson Davis Parish between the years 2005 and 2008 or 9, and they remain unsolved. It's a terrible story, but Dave is drawn into the fictional story through his friend Cleet Purcell, and discovers that there's an amazing level of disinterest in the case, because the victims are marginalized people and they have no voice and they have no power. And unfortunately, that's just often the case. It's not Louisiana, it's anywhere. Victims very often of predators are people who live on the rim of society, and they don't have high visibility.
And Jim, when Dave starts investigating this, he goes out of his own jurisdiction, as he's wont to do, and he visits Mississippi, where he meets Elmore. And could you tell me how to pronounce that last name?
Elmore Latchley.
Latchley. Okay.
Yeah.
And I liked Elmore Latchley because he kind of just lays it on the line to Dave, and he says, "I know who did it, and you guys didn't care then, and you don't care now."
Yeah.
And you kind of show the treatment of these guys that are in jail there in Mississippi. And there's a beautiful moment in the book where Dave's talking to the guy who, the prison guard, and he kind of feels a bit of a kinship with him, and then he's just kind of repulsed by the thought, which I really, really liked.
Yeah, Dave finds himself in that very uncomfortable position of talking to a gunbull here, a mounted prison guard, a man with a double-barrel shotgun, who has killed five men, some on the job, sometimes outside the penitentiary, killed a man in a bar over a woman. And Dave has a hard time talking with this man. As he says, he likes to feel that redemption is working incrementally in all of us. And then he realizes this fellow is the lawman that all good lawmen fear they might become. Mm-hmm. A cruel and violent man.
Mm-hmm. And the conditions that he described are just, they're brutal at best. And then but Elmore mentions the name Herman Stanga, and this guy is a real piece of work.
Yeah.
And each time I read one of your novels, I think to myself, there's no way he can come up with someone more despicable than some of the others, but Herman might be he's one of the best ones in terms of just being, not having a lot of good qualities, shall we say.
Yeah, Herman is a black procurer and dope peddler, and he fills Dave with just visceral loathing. Dave says, to the degree that Dave never allows himself to be alone and armed with Herman. Dave despises this guy because of this man's willingness to victimize his own people. But all of the villains in this story, or anything I've written, are based on some antecedent, I mean, some biographical character or a combination of biographical characters. I didn't make them up. And I've never written about anything that does not have some basis in fact. Otherwise, it would be, a kind of manufactured voyeurism. I knew someone like Hermann Stenger, and he's not a unique character. There's nothing lower, ultimately, in a minority community than some man who addicts other people deliberately, who ruins people's lives. He literally steals their souls.
And the attention to detail which you give, and I think that's what really separates your writing from a lot of other writers, is just some of the details that you give, and we won't give them away, of what Hermann Stenger does to the neighborhood that he moves into. It's just, it's depravity, but yet it makes sense in a sick way. You can understand why he's doing it, because he's making up for past sins, if you will, and he's trying to figure out a way to make some money himself. And it's really kind of brilliant when you think about it, but it's tough for Dave to hear this, and then ultimately for Cleet to hear this, because the guy does not have a lot of good qualities about him.
No, we discovered that Hermann was the son of a prostitute who had a terrible life as a child, but he is not a sociopath. He's simply an amoral pragmatist. We meet some other people in this book, though, who are far more wicked even than Hermann is. Hermann is one of those guys we allow to function. There's a term for this in anthropology and sociology: cognitive dissonance. There's a reason for every functional aberration inside a society. We create a around it, but we allow it to exist because it serves a collective purpose. Gambling, prostitution, the purveyors of dope, standing on street corners in minority neighborhoods. These things are all done with consent. Anyone who believes otherwise should only then interest them in some costume jewelry. But they're allowed to do these things. This is how we often deal with certain kinds of vices. They're there with permission. Usually they're contained. There's certain neighborhoods that are just sort of offered up as sacrificial parts of town. I mean, think of it this way. The greatest power in any city is vested in the zoning board. Zoning boards have enormous power over an urban area. And there's certain neighborhoods that are, in effect, battlegrounds for, things that people don't want to see, in their own neighborhoods. We let the gangbangers operate in one neighborhood. They're not allowed to do what they do in another neighborhood. The way it is. De facto, we've already legalized drugs in this country, but only in certain areas.
Yeah, that's a good
point. I used
to
live in a slum. I used to live in South Los Angeles. It was a great lesson for me when you see the discrepancy between the normal world and the economics of a slum.
And living in Orlando, I see the same thing with Disney World and the, the neighborhoods where you just don't go into after the sun goes down. But Jim, another fascinating character is, or a family, is the Abelard family, who kind of fall into a different category. They're more socially acceptable, and they've been in part of the town for years. And I really is fascinated with Timothy Abelard.
Yeah, he is the patriarch of the family. And as you say, this group of people have much more of a pernicious influence on the society and the physical environment surrounding them than these marginal characters like Hermann and a few of his peers. The the people who operate within the dynamics, within the economic parameters of the slum, have a minimal influence on our society. But people like the Abelards, who are power brokers, people of enormous wealth, in this instance have inherited an Edenic paradise. The Louisiana of years ago, it was a green, gold, just absolute creation that James Audubon could have painted. But they traded it all for the short-term gain of the profits offered them by the petrochemical industry. And when we meet this family in the book, we see the consequence of their choice. And they've poisoned the lagoons around their plantation home. The freshwater marsh has been systemically killed by saline intrusion. And in effect, they have become the serpent in the tree. They didn't have to go find one in biblical mythology. They were the instrument of their undoing.
And Jim, the as I was working my way through the first 100-150 pages, and I'm understanding the plot and the mystery, all of a sudden I started seeing this very complex love stories developing in the Glass Rainbow, and I think that the love story between Dave and Allifair is very fully developed in this novel, and I think you do a wonderful job of showing the unconditional love that Dave has for Allifair, and she's kind of getting involved with the Abelards, and I thought it was very effective how just kind of a not even coming of age, she's older than that, but just the love that he has for her, I think you just do a beautiful job writing about it.
Well, thanks very much. Allifair Robichaux is a great character, and of course our daughter Allifair Burke we think is a great person too, and both are novelists. And the fictitious Allifair, of course, is a Reed College graduate and a Stanford Law student, as our Allifair was. And, you know, Allifair Burke has published 6 novels now. But Dave goes through a trying time here when Allifair becomes involved with this celebrity ex-convict, a man who's written a best-selling book about his time in prison titled The Green Cage. And this guy is far more loathsome even than Herman Stenga. Yeah, his name is Robert Weingart, a just really horrible human being whom Cleet Purcell cannot wait to tear apart with his bare hands.
Yes. Yeah. And you know, speaking of like some of the love themes again, it seems there's a maturing of Dave and Cleet's relationship in the Glass Rainbow. It's like there's kind of a sense of mortality that begins to develop, and it seems like Dave is beginning. He seems to accept Cleet a little bit more in this book. It doesn't seem like there's quite the angst. They're on the same team. They're the Bobbsey twins again.
Yeah.
And did you feel that when you were writing it, or did that?
Correct. Yes. Absolutely. There are certain things we learn in our lives, if we ever learn anything. But sometime within the 9 innings that were allocated, we have a few epiphanies. And I don't think much wisdom comes with age. It certainly has eluded me. But there are a few things that we grasp maybe somewhere during the 7th inning stretch. And one of those is that, well, mortality seems to press upon us, the presence of death and, you know, its inevitability. But also about this time, we begin to realize that death has always been our companion, that it is a lot of what the definition of human life is about. We were not aware of it. We always saw it as an abstraction, a kind of presence that Yes would eventually have to joust with, as though somehow we could negotiate our situation. But when we look back over our shoulder, we realize it was all always there, and that our lives could have ended in many ways, in many instances over the years, just in a blink, a wrong turn into the wrong neighborhood, a truck veering across the center stripe, a bolt of lightning bouncing off of a power line. It was always there. We just didn't recognize it as such. And when we realize that, we no longer think of our lives in terms of either sequence or solar time. We start to think of our lives in terms of the daily experience. And when that happens, people lose their fear of death. It's a very liberating moment, finally. But also we realize that the moments that had separated us from our fellow man, either through anger, envy, resentment, whatever, those issues just seem to dissolve. They just blow away in the wind. They're not of consequence anymore. It's the only thing you get with age, and it doesn't necessarily come, but if you get anything from age, that's the one gift. It's detachment and indifference.
Well, very well said, and it's very interesting. Again, I'm not giving anything away. In Tin Roof Blowdown, there were a couple pages when I read them, I had to set the book down. I was so moved by the relationship between Dave and Cleet, and I must tell you, and I'm not ashamed to tell the listeners this, that when I finished this book, I put the book down and I wept unashamedly for 5 to 10 minutes at the beauty of the way you pulled this, the last two pages of prose that you put together. In the Glass Rainbow, I was just absolutely moved by the writing and the beauty of what you conveyed.
Well, thanks very much. I appreciate that, Casey. Louisiana is a tragedy, and it has all the proportions of an Elizabethan tragedy. It was it's hard to explain to people how beautiful the state of Louisiana once was. And what has been done to it, or what collectively has been allowed to occur there, is just a tragedy of enormous proportions. And the well blowout at the Deepwater Horizon drilling platform was something that was, I think, decades in the making. It was the perfect storm. These guys did it. They created the perfect storm. And this is not something that's going to be cleaned up. People who do oil recovery, who scoop oil and burn it, and do whatever they can to dispose of it, I think usually estimate that a 20% success rate, that's as good as it gets. 80% of whatever got loose in the environment is in there for decades. Plus, in this case, the dispersants have sunk the oil, see, out of people's vision, but it's down there on the bottom of the ocean floor, on the ocean floor. It's going to be with us a long time, and these guys did it, but they did it with sanction because they provide people with cheap fuel. That's the issue. That has been the issue since 1914. It was the issue in the invasion of Iraq, the invasion of Afghanistan. It's the issue today. People want cheap gas, and if it costs a lot of human blood and sacrifice and misery, unfortunately, there are many people who are quite willing to pay that price, usually, you know, at the cost of others. But that's what has occurred, and that's not an opinion. I mean, this is has been the history of the last 100 years. T.E. Lawrence's book, The Seven Pillars of Wisdom, deals with his experience as a British commando advising Saudi troops against the Turks out in the desert in 1915. It's probably the best book ever written on neo-colonialism. search for new energy or fuel sources and what he saw as the future of the Western world. It's a brilliant book. If we read that book, we would never do the things we're doing today. We'd find another way. But anyway, that's the era in which we live, and that's what the book is about. It's an allegory, really. The Abelards are the old vestiges of a neo-colonial empire. They happen to live in Louisiana, but Joseph Conrad, I think, would recognize them immediately.
Mm-hmm. And it was on page 242. It's almost as if you're prescient when there's a paragraph which just begins, "How about oil?" And you talk about how Louisiana, about this exploitation, and this was before the catastrophe had occurred. And so I guess what you're saying is you've seen this coming for much longer, being a native of Louisiana, than those of us who lived in the other areas of the country perhaps have seen.
Well, it's not because, I appreciate what you say, Casey, but it's not because I'm prescient. You're correct. Everyone who has lived around oil exploration or who has worked in it knew how this whole scenario was going to play out. And that's why I think in Louisiana there's such anger. People are really angry. And from the day that the Deepwater Horizon well blew out, all of the events that followed were a foregone conclusion. There was no way that any other consequence could occur. And this is why the statements of these men, these oil executives, are so troubling, because they knew better. And I voted for President Obama. I think he's a decent and good man. But he is not experienced in dealing with men like this. They do business with baseball bats. And these guys were lying through their teeth. Believe me, these guys lied. Number one, 5,000 feet, a blowout is uncontrollable. The term, the language used to describe it to begin with was dishonest. This is not an oil spill. An oil spill involves a leak from, say, a ruptured tanker. Number one, the volume of oil that can go into the environment is already limited. It's within a structure. After it all leaks out of the structure, it's gone. And it can be recovered. Most of it stays on the top of the water. A blowout is perhaps an infinite source underneath it. And it's going to come out under thousands and thousands of pounds of pressure. At 5,000 feet, it's a three-dimensional catastrophe. Secondly, there's no way effectively to shut it off, as we've seen. It all has to be done robotically. And lastly, the damage is systemic. It will last for decades. And in this case, the alluvial flow of the Mississippi River at the mouth flows directly westward. There was no way in the world that oil could go anywhere except into the Louisiana wetlands, from the mouth of the Mississippi into Barataria Bay, into Marsh Island, Vermilion Bay, plumb down to Galveston, maybe on to Corpus Christi in Mexico. That had to happen. There was no way it could not happen. Anyone who's flown over that area can see it from an airplane. You can see the mud that is flowing westward immediately south of New Orleans. It's a big, giant cloud of mud. That's the siltation that rebuilds the coastline. That's how Mother Nature designed it. In the meantime, the Gulf Stream oscillates eastward. So that's what I mean when I say these guys created the perfect storm. What did not flow into the Louisiana wetlands would flow across the Mississippi, Alabama, and Florida coast. These guys originally said maybe it wasn't 1,000, barrels a day were going into the environment. The figure was, I don't know how many times higher. Was it 30,000, 40,000, 50,000? They weren't even close. And then one of their executives went on worldwide TV, this is a literal quote, and said, this accident will have, quote, a very, very modest impact on the environment. Well, this was not simply an attempt to hide their culpability. That's pernicious enough. They gave false information to the government about the gravity of the situation. Unfortunately, I don't think Mr. Obama knows very much about the oil business, the technology involved, but that's not his fault. His fault is that he didn't get people on board who were knowledgeable. And here we have the United States government, the most powerful institution on the planet, listening to a bunch of con men. And daily, these guys would just, when they finished telling one lie or making one promise they didn't keep, they simply told another. It was kind of like listening to P.T. Barnum to tell people his story about the Cardiff Giant. So people down there are listening to this stuff. They knew what was going to happen. Not simply was their environment going to be destroyed, they were going to lose their livelihood. So this is why people are very angry. And they're angry because that they feel, one, they don't have any voice. And number two, there's no way to reverse what's happened. That some of that oil has gone 20 miles into the wetlands. I didn't mean to talk your arm off with all this stuff. But look, over the decades, the oil companies have cut 10,000 miles, 10,000 miles of canals from salt water into freshwater marsh areas. Those marsh areas have been permanently poisoned. Saline intrusion systemically kills the root systems, both in the native grasses and in the submerged trees, the cypress and the gum and the willow trees, that literally knit the land together. The consequence has been that every year, something like 25 miles of the Louisiana coast is washed away. It's disappearing. This now is going to be increased in terms of the situation is going to become more deleterious after the oil surge follows the same conduit into those marshes. And we haven't begun the hurricane season yet. That's when it's going to happen. All that sludge that's there on the floor of the Gulf is going one place, and that's right into the wetlands. There is no way around that conclusion, and these guys know that. Mm-hmm. And they keep saying again and again, come back and see how things are in 2 years or 3 years. We're going to clean up every bit of this. They don't have, they won't be anything to clean up. It won't be there. The land will not be there any longer. So it's kind of like wanting to have Wyatt Earp on the job. Mm-hmm. Those Clantons are burning down the town. They say, where's Wyatt? Mm-hmm. And Doc mm-hmm. Holliday and Virgil.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Morgan and the gang. Instead, we have the Clantons flying to their
feet. Right.
While Wyatt nods his head in agreement.
Yeah.
It's pretty depressing.
Yeah. No, I appreciate you sharing that, Jim, because I was hoping you would, because I know you have a better working knowledge, a better understanding of all of that than certainly most people do, and so I do thank you for sharing that. And then I've got to tell you that maybe the one woman who could help would be Emma Poach.
Yeah.
Set her loose down in Louisiana.
Emma Poach, the deputy sheriff? Yeah.
Yes.
She's great.
Yeah. Now, she might be able to get these guys whipped into shape, because I love her character.
Yeah, she's kind of Cleet's girlfriend for a while.
Yeah.
Emma's kind of dangerous.
Yeah, you had to quote, she lived one drink and one clip away from the big exit. And I read that, and I started laughing because I said, boy, isn't that the truth,
Yeah. You
know? And, but, you know, it's I thought she was a great character,
Yeah. You
know, in the book because this is also an interesting, and I've got to tell you, on a lot in most of the Robichaux books and most of your work, you know you can see behind the scenes. I can see the literary themes,
Yeah. And
you know, and but on page 420, one of the characters said, you know, this is Gone with the Wind, and the one character said, and one guy says, no, this is Tennessee Williams Suddenly Last Summer. And I put a bookmark in the book because it hit me. I said, yes, this Robert Weingart and Vidor Perkins, these are kind of Tennessee Williams characters 50 years down the road. This is what happened to all of the people in Streetcar Named Desire, and this is what happened when they bred together.
Yeah. pretty wretched lot. That's right. Boy, you know, Williams wrote some great plays, and did you ever read a book titled The One-Armed Bandit and Other Stories and Poems by Tennessee Williams?
I have.
The seed of all his plays are in that collection of poems and short stories. And, of course, those the portrayal and the point of view are very extreme, and we meet these predatory characters. I mean, they're literally cannibals.
Yes. Yeah.
Williams' perspective is pretty horrifying.
Well, and when you introduced Vidor Perkins, I kind of thought of and Robert more Robert Weingart. I kind of thought of Montgomery Clift. You know, this guy was kind of Montgomery Clift, and at the time when Williams wrote that screenplay with Gore Vidal, they had to edit out all the homosexual references and everything in the movie, but I mean, it didn't take, you know, you didn't have to be a Philadelphia lawyer to figure out what they were writing about, but I love that reference to Suddenly Last Summer because to me it just tied things together there, and I had not heard you write or talk about Williams before.
Yeah, well, he had a lot of influence on my work, no doubt about it. And he was a great playwright. And had he not lived during the era he did, I believe he would have been a Nobel recipient. I think he was unfairly passed over, but probably because of his lifestyle. You know, his behavior was considered outrageous at the time, and probably even today.
Yeah.
Williams would be considered a pretty outrageous, irreverent.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
But what a talent. And A Streetcar Named Desire is one of the greatest plays ever written, I think.
Yeah.
I didn't know that Gore Vidal co-wrote the screenplay for Suddenly Last Summer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, in 1959. It was originally done as a one-act play on Broadway. Suddenly Last Summer, and that was in 57, and then in 59 the film with Elizabeth Taylor, Katharine Hepburn, and Cliff. Yeah, but it was originally done as a one-act play, and then the screenplay in 59 was Gore Vidal and Williams co-wrote the screenplay.
Well, I'll be darned. Did you ever see Orpheus Descending?
I have not.
Oh, you'd love that play. Golly. And it's one of Williams' best, and also, it deals with this violent legacy in the South that we oftentimes just don't want to recognize. But it's set in New Orleans and Mississippi and deals with a guitar player and male prostitute by the name of Valentine Xavier. And he was played by Marlon Brando in the film. And I think it was one of Brando's best roles. But again, the themes were so severe that a lot of audiences, I think, were probably alienated, you know, by the rawness of the material.
Yeah, you know, Williams was, there was a book called Hollywood's Ten Tennessee, which was written about a year and a half ago by a couple professors. And in a 20-year period, 15 of his plays were turned into films, which is just an incredible,
It's called Hollywood's Tennessee.
Hollywood's Tennessee by Robert Bray.
By whom?
Robert Bray, B-R-A-Y.
Okay.
Yeah, Hollywood's Tennessee, and Texas University Press published it.
Okay, got to get that.
Yeah. And Jim, before I let you go, I also enjoy, I think Tripod is one of the great animal characters in any series. And I know Stephen King hates cats and, you know, other people dislike dogs and stuff, but Tripod, he has a nice role in this. Even Tripod's getting on now, and I thought it was very touching, you know, the Tripod is dealing with his own mortality.
Yeah, Tripod's a great character, and one of the themes in the book is the importance to protect animals.
Mm-hmm.
And I've always subscribed to the belief that those who do not feel affection for animals are not quite dealing with the spiritual realities that define us. And you know what we forget when we look into the Bible, or we quote from the Bible, is the story of Noah. And prior to the flood, man lived in harmony with the animals. The Bible says, I think, that no knife drew the blood of an animal. We forget that was the world in which Yahweh planned for us to live.
Mm-hmm. That's a very good point.
Yeah.
Very good point.
Yeah. Well, you remember then the prophecy about the end of times, that the lion will lie down with the lamb.
Mm-hmm.
But again, the Bible has a lot to say about animals and the fact that we're supposed to be stewards and to make the world a harmonious place, not simply for ourselves, but for our fellow creatures.
Yeah,
Tripod's a great, I think, symbol of that, and Dave's and Alifair's affection, and Molly's affection for Tripod.
Yes, yeah, I agree. Jim, I know that the last time when we talked after Katrina, you gave me the name of an organization that we featured on the website.
Yeah.
And I think they're still doing good works. Is that the case?
Yeah, they're fine people, the Catholic Activist Nuns at Southern Mutual in Liberia.
So should we promote them again? Are they helping with the spill, helping the people in the area down there?
They are, and they have different kinds of projects. Urban renewal is one of them. They're helping rebuild a slum area, a ghetto area there on one side of New Iberia. And they have many projects, so a person can earmark his contribution to, say, for the relief of people affected by the oil well blowout.
Okay.
That's what I do. And they help. The ladies at Southern Mutual are really very good people, Sister Lorna and Sister Helen. And they went... The Southern Mutual Nuns, those who founded the group, came to the area in the 70s to organize the sugarcane workers. Can you imagine how that was received?
No.
You know, Dave Robichaux says, if you want a stand-up woman in your life, marry a Catholic nun. But anyway, they do an enormous amount of good, Sister Helen, Sister Lorna, and they help fisher people, small business people, working people, poor people, people of color. They're just very fine people.
Good. Well, we'll promote them again, because I visited their site again before while I was setting up this interview, and I saw they were continuing their good work, so we'll put in a plug for them again.
Well, thanks a million.
Yeah, and Jim, have you before I let you go, what are you happiest about with The Glass Rainbow now that it's in bookstores? And by the way, like I've been telling people, you know, There have been two books I've really been impressed with. I really liked Innocent by Scott Turow. I thought it was a great book. And now The Glass Rainbow. I'm telling people, if you're looking for a book to take with you on vacation, this is, you know, this is a beauty. What are you happiest about?
Well, it's allegorical. And I think if people would like to see the future under a petrochemical oligarchy, they need to visit Louisiana and see how they like it.
Okay.
And ask, we need to ask ourselves, how much are we willing to do or pay in terms of our environment, our quality of life, our foreign policy, in order to drive an SUV or to have cheap gas? How much are we willing to pay? Yeah. That's the question.
Okay, very good. Well, Jim, as always, it's been a pleasure, and this is the Casey Kowar Show, a celebration of words. We've been visiting with James Lee Burke today, discussing The Glass Rainbow, now available in bookstores and online. Jim, thank you for your the generous amount of time, and thank you for writing another beautiful novel, and I look forward to getting caught up with you when the next one comes out.
Well, thanks a million, Casey. It's always a pleasure and an honor to be on your show.
Okay. You take care of yourself, my friend.
You too. See you, partner.
Okay. See ya.
Thanks, Chuck. Bye-bye.